Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for July 5th, 2018. On today's episode, we're going to talk about a little bit of film and TV news, and then we're going to jump into our feature presentation, which is the best films of the first half of 2018. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Soretta, and joining me on today's podcast are Slash Film Senior Writer Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's going on?
And writers Y Trend Bowie.
Hey, everyone.
And Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
Okay, before we get into our feature presentation, we should say that the news is very slow. You know, it's a holiday week, and everybody in Hollywood tends to, you know, take, the day before and the day after a holiday off, which means that not much news has been hitting the wires today. But we do have one little bit of news, and that includes, revolves around the Fast and the Furious franchise. Ben, tell us about it.
Yeah, so Idris Elba has been cast as the villain in the first Fast and Furious spinoff, which is called Hobbs and Shaw. This is the movie that features Dwayne Johnson's special agent Luke Hobbs and Jason Statham's Deckard Shaw teaming up to apparently face off against a character played by Idris Elba. We don't know anything about his villain character other than he's just the main bad guy in the movie. But I don't know. Elba is like a really terrific actor. He's super physical, and I feel like he has the ability to, you know, go toe to toe with these guys if they want to get into like a physical brawl. He could also do, you know, some more mental psychological games with them as well. So I feel like there's a lot of opportunity here. I love him as an actor, and I think this is a chance for him to step into something that's a lot more fun than the work that he's been doing recently. Like, I'm thinking specifically about
the Dark Tower.
The Dark Tower. And like, this has got to be this movie is going to be so goofy and ridiculous and over the top, because that's what all these Fast and Furious movies are. So I have to think that he's going to have a lot of fun in this movie, and he's going to be a lot of fun to watch going head to head with those guys.
But is this just another case of, you know, the guy with the English accent being the villain in a big, you know, blockbuster spy heist movie?
Kind of, but I hope that they actually lean into that, because I feel like Idris Elba has not been able to use his natural English accent very much in movies recently, or at least in mainstream blockbuster stuff. So I think that if he plays maybe like a former associate of Deckard Shaw or something, who is in the British military in the Fast and Furious verse, then maybe that would be a cool opportunity for him to just sort of play like a fast and loose and like a use his actual natural accent in this film.
Okay, guys, let's jump into our feature presentation, and that is the best movies of 2018 so far. This week on the site, we've been publishing your list, the list of the Slash Film contributors, listing their favorite movies that they've seen this year so far. And so far, Chris and Ben have published their list. HT's list hits the site tomorrow, but we're going to get a preview here. I did a non-scientific mathematical calculation and ordered the list based on the highest any one of the contributors has it on the list. And we're going to talk about all the films that are on any of these three lists right now. I think this is a great chance because, the first half of the year isn't as daunting as the last half of the year with all the Oscar bait and awards consideration films. And there were some great films. Actually, looking at this list, I am shocked at how many films I have not seen. So I think this is a great chance for the Slash Film Daily listeners and myself to get caught up on some of these films and maybe put some of these movies on their radars so they can go check it out before that wave of award stuff happens starting this fall. Let's start this out with Chris's number 10, and that is The Endless. Chris, tell us about it.
The Endless is the latest film from Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. They're this duo who make really unique, kind of quirky indie horror films. Their first film was called Resolution, and they followed that up with a movie called Spring, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's just this weird romantic horror movie, and this is their latest, and it's really good. It's not quite as good as Spring, but I loved it still. It's about two brothers who escaped from a UFO death cult when they were kids. And one of the two has found life on the outside to be kind of just depressing. Like, he misses living with the cult. And as fate has it, the cult call them back, and they go back to just sort of pay a visit to get closure. And while once they get there, things get really weird. I mean, the less I say about this, the better, because it's one of those movies where the less you know, the more exciting it is. But it's great. It's just one of these really strange, unique films. And what I love about Benson and Moorhead is, you know, while their films are technically horror, they also put a lot of like humanity and heart into them. And this film is like that too, where it has this sort of nice message buried in all the weird, creepy stuff.
What genre of film would you place this in? Because I really haven't heard anything about this film other from you.
I'd say this is like sci-fi, horror, thriller, drama. It's like all of those combined.
I mean, looking at some of the screenshots from this film, it looks beautiful. It's getting 97% of Rotten Tomatoes. So I'm definitely going to have to check this out. Let's move on to our number two movie here. That is Ant-Man and the Wasp. And I should explain before Ben talks about this film that the way we put together these lists were it was any movie that we had personally seen in the first half of 2018. So even though Ant-Man and the Wasp isn't out until, what, tonight or tomorrow? You know, it made Ben's list at number 10. So, Ben, tell us about it.
Yeah, I really liked this movie a lot. I think there's no question in my mind that Avengers Infinity War is like a more impressive and substantial movie in Marvel Studios in the grand scheme of everything that Marvel's got going on. But I feel like Ant-Man and the Wasp, because the comedy works so well in this movie, and I won't spoil anything about the movie, and everybody already knows what the basic gist of this film is. I don't even really need to go into that, but I just want to give it some props because I think the humor works so well in this movie, and that's something that I feel like even, you know, culturally and even as movie writers, sometimes what we do, we tend to devalue comedies in rankings like these. And I think Ant-Man and the Wasp shows how Peyton Reed and Paul Rudd and all the people involved with this movie, how easy they make it look. And just thinking about how it's not easy to make a comedy like this where most of the jokes land, which is a big deal for me because I feel like in most studio comedies, I'm only laughing at, I don't know, 10 or 15% of the jokes. But this one was like up there, I don't know, it was like 80, 90% or something for me. I don't know the actual mathematical breakdown, but this film was hilarious. Michael Peña comes in and just steals every scene he's in. And it's definitely a lighter, sort of fluffier movie, but I feel like I would be doing it a disservice if I didn't give it some credit for nailing the comedy as well as it does.
You know, I'm shocked that you put this on your list, but not Infinity War. But you explained it, and I will give a spoiler for this entire list. Infinity War did not make any of the contributors here's lists, but there is another Marvel movie. We'll talk about that later. But let's move on to a documentary. Won't You Be My Neighbor, which we've talked about extensively on this podcast. But HT, tell us why you loved it.
So Won't You Be My Neighbor is the documentary about Fred Rogers, his life and legacy, as the host of the popular children's TV show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And it's directed by Morgan Neville and kind of compiles footage from the show as well as some home videos of Fred Rogers behind the scenes, kind of shows him the man behind the curtain, so to speak. And it's such a touching, affecting, and heartwarming film that I felt like really embodied that this new strain of movies that just preach the good in people. And I really love to see that movies that really speak to and tap into like the good in humanity and that kind of thing. And I know Ben had some criticisms last week of, you know, not being able to see some of like his struggles and everything like that. And I do like the idea that I would have liked the idea of seeing some of that as well, but I think that the more important thing is like the message that he relayed and the way that he plays such a formative part in many children's, including mine, my childhood. So it's just such a lovely documentary that really just is able to almost imitate that feeling that watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood gave as a kid, just like that the world will be all right.
This is a film that pretty much everybody loves. I think there's 150 reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, and there's only one rotten. And it's some guy from the film stage who basically gave it a C because, you know, there isn't basically the criticism that Chris gave it. I would say everybody should go out and check out that film. Another film we've talked about earlier in the year, The Death of Stalin. Chris and HT both had it on their list, but Chris, tell us about it.
I saw The Death of Stalin last year at TIFF, and it just finally came out this year. And it's from Armando Iannucci, who created Veep and directed In the Loop. And it's this very funny, very dark movie about the chaotic, comical fallout that happened in the Soviet Union after, Stalin died and all his advisors were jockeying for power. And this is one of the weirdest comedies I've ever seen because it's very funny. It's like hysterically funny, but it's also insanely dark. Like, this is one of the darkest comedies I've ever seen. Like, almost every scene has people being like rounded up and murdered in the background. And yet somehow it, you know, through all of that, it remains very funny. And it's almost impossible to nail a tone like that. Like, I don't think many filmmakers could make this subject matter seem so funny, but it works really well somehow.
Let's talk about another film. This is a small film that I think got a lot of acclaim, and that is The Quiet Place. Ben, you had this number 8. Chris had it number 9. Tell us about it.
Yeah, John Krasinski directed this movie. I'm sure everybody, because the film was such a huge hit, I'm sure everybody knows the premise, but it's basically an alien invasion has taken over Earth, and this family has to stay alive by not making any sound because the aliens are attracted to any noise that's over, you know, a whisper, basically. I think Krasinski did a really wonderful job with this movie, and he surprised a lot of people as the director. I think the film itself sort of weaponizes sound in this really interesting way that sort of brought the movie theaters, at least that I was in, into, you know, basically, which are like loud places and kind of obnoxious places where people tend to react terribly to movies and behave like they're animals, frankly. It sort of forced everyone to be quiet because that's what this whole movie is sort of hinged on. Emily Blunt is terrific in this movie. I feel like if Oscar voters took horror movies a little bit more seriously, or at least mainstream horror movies like this, that she might actually get some awards consideration because she is so good in this film as the mother. She plays the mother opposite John Krasinski himself, who is also really good in the movie, and the kids are great. The whole cast is really solid here. And yeah, just I really enjoyed this movie. It surprised the hell out of me. And I think, it's probably going to get some technical achievements later in the year when award season rolls around. But man, this movie is really good.
Yeah, I'm not making a best of the first half list just because I feel like I haven't seen enough films out of all the ones that you guys are listing here. But A Quiet Place would definitely make my best of the first half if I had made one. But let's talk about another film, Ben, Lizzie. Tell us about Lizzie.
Yeah, Lizzie is really great. I saw it at Sundance, and it comes out on September 14th. So I know this one's out of reach for people at the moment, but I just want to put it on everybody's radar. Chloe Sevigny, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, so I apologize for that, and Kristen Stewart are the leads in this movie. And it's basically about the story of Lizzie Borden, who you guys probably all know. The gist of it, of her story, is that she murdered her parents in this big axe murder. And it's sort of turned into like a children's like a sing-song sort of nursery rhyme kind of thing. And I basically, that's all I knew about the character of Lizzie Borden going into this movie. But it really sort of spins the whole thing on its head and tells the story from Lizzie's point of view. And it takes her from this monster that she, you know, appears as in these history books that we've learned about her, you know, over the years, and presents her as this like righteous heroine who, it definitely takes extreme action, but it's understandable where she's coming from because you see that she's been abused in this family. And I don't want to give anything away because this movie goes to some unexpected places, but the performances are really spectacular. And the whole movie, I think, works really, really perfectly, and especially where we are culturally right now and in this sort of post-Weinstein moment. Anybody who feels, you know, oppressed or or held down in any way, I feel like it's going to really relate to the messages of this film. And it gets pretty brutal with the violence and you know, spoiler alert, Lizzie Borden murders her parents in this movie, but and it's pretty graphic. But I think you understand the humanity of her character. And yeah, Kristen Stewart, I feel like she's, you know, for anybody who has still written her off as just that actress from Twilight, watch this movie because she's really great in it.
Yeah, I feel like not being at Sundance really hurt me from a critical standpoint of going into this year. I was sent home from Sundance with an injury, and a bunch of the films on this list come from Sundance. So, you know, Sundance is really a place that kind of kickstarts the year of, you know, these kind of indie and smaller films. Let's move on to a film that is not one of those, and that is Tully. HD, you had this on your list at number 6.
Yes. So Tully is the third collaboration between screenwriter Diablo Cody and director Jason Reitman after Juno and Young Adult, and it also stars Charlize Theron as a struggling mother who had just given birth to her third child and is essentially really struggling with postpartum depression. And things sort of change when a nighttime nanny named Tully comes to help. And it's a really great story about motherhood and like the hellish situation that a lot of mothers like find themselves in. And it's Charlize Theron is amazing as this worn down and weary mother at the heart of it. And it's just like, it's such a tender and really heartbreakingly filmed movie that has a twist at the end that kind of elevates it from a good movie to a great movie. I can't spoil it, but it's a movie about motherhood that people might be put off from because it's not really particularly about them, or they don't really want to know more about like the reality of life because it's a little depressing. But I encourage anyone who isn't a mother or who hasn't experienced these kind of things to see it because it's just phenomenally performed, wonderfully directed. And I think it's definitely Diablo Cody and Jason Reitman's best film since Juno, if not better than Juno, I think.
Yeah, it's great to see Reitman and Cody making a comeback after a couple, you know, not considered successful entries into film and TV. Although Reitman's producing that Casual show on Hulu, which I haven't seen, I've heard good things about. But let's move on to Revenge. Chris, this was on your list at number 6. Tell us about it.
Yes, Revenge is a very brutal, probably too brutal for some viewers, film. It's about this woman. She's having this affair with this married man, and they're in a secluded hideaway. I think it's somewhere near Las Vegas, and they're in the desert, and it's supposed to be just them two alone. And this guy's two very oafish, terrible friends show up and ruin everything. And I won't give away what happens, but it results in this young woman basically having to both fight for her life and also seek revenge against these terrible three guys. And this movie is incredible. Like I said, it's a brutal movie, so it's not going to be for everyone. The violence in this film is extreme to the point where it's almost unrealistic. Like, the amount of blood that comes out of people in this movie, I don't think actual humans have this much blood in their body. It's like insane. But if you can stomach it, this film is fantastic. It's just incredibly directed. It looks just visually amazing. And I don't know, I really liked it.
Okay, let's move on to Ben's number 6 movie, and that is Blindspotting. Ben, tell us about
it. This is another one that I saw at Sundance, and it comes out sooner. It comes out on July 20th, so there's only a couple more weeks to wait for people to get a chance to see this one. And I really think everybody should see this because Hamilton star Daveed Diggs is the lead in this film, and it is pretty incredible. It's a movie that is really hilarious, but it's also emotional, and it's about a lot of things like racial trauma. One of the characters sees an unarmed black man get gunned down in the streets by a police officer, so that's like a pretty timely thing right now, obviously. But it also sort of tackles these ideas and big themes, you know, identity and perception. And there are stylistic flourishes in this movie that might sound ridiculous when I explain them. Like at one point, actually multiple times throughout the movie, some of the cast members freestyle rap some of the dialogue. And that, I know that sounds really, really goofy, but it actually works really well in context. And the huge climax that this movie reaches at the end is unlike anything I've ever seen in any other movie. It's super unique and very it's unexpected and weird and very dramatic, I guess, is one of the best ways to describe it. But David Diggs, I think, is definitely going to be a star on the rise after this movie. It's one of those, it's a passion project. I think he and his co-writer, who also co-stars in the film with him, have been trying to get this movie made for years and years and years. And now finally, because of the success of Hamilton, I think he probably has a little bit more of the clout and name recognition to actually get this movie made. And I think Lionsgate is putting it out on July 20th. So just a couple more weeks. But this movie it's very powerful. It's like I said, it has a lot, it wrestles with a lot of big ideas, but it's also very, very funny. So I think it's definitely a crowd pleaser and people are going to get a kick out of this one.
Yeah, another one of those movies that isn't out quite yet, but is coming out later this summer is Madeline's Madeline. And that was one of Chris's top picks. Chris, number five. Chris, tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a film from Josephine Decker. She makes very obscure, I guess you'd call them art films. This is definitely the best film she's made yet. It's about this young woman played by Helena Howard, who's I think this is her first film, and she's in this acting class, but she's also, it's very vague and deliberately so, but it's clear she has some sort of mental, health problems where she was institutionalized and she's on medication, and she's obsessed with acting to the point where she literally becomes other people by studying them. Like she sees someone on the street and she can turn into that person. And, but the film is very strange and dreamlike. There's all these very weird close-ups and out of focus stuff. And I know that sounds really pretentious and arty, but it doesn't come across that way when you're watching the film. It's a phenomenal movie. It puts you in the headspace of this main character, but then as the film progresses, it's not really clear if it's really in her headspace or if it's in the headspace of someone else in the movie. It's a very strange, unclassifiable film, and I don't know, I really liked it.
And this movie comes out August 10th in limited theaters, so you might have to, you know, seek this one out. But a big movie that, you know, a wide release that hit theaters, a comedy of all sorts. I think this might be one of the only all-out comedies on this list. You know, I guess Ant-Man's kind of a comedy, is Game Night. And HT, you alone had this as your number five. Why?
Game Night is great, guys. I don't know why you guys don't have it on your top 10, but it was a movie that gave me a hope again in studio comedies, that they're no longer just broad and silly and crude, but that they can be funny and clever and stylishly directed. So Game Night is directed by John Francis Daley and Jonathan Goldstein, and it follows a couple who are obsessed and overly competitive when it comes to games, and they host a weekly game night with their friends that suddenly turns dangerous when the Jason Bateman's character's older brother comes into town and introduces a sort of murder mystery night that turns into an actual murder mystery. And it sounds like the premise for a pretty silly movie, but it's so energetically directed, and Rachel McAdams and Jason Bateman are hilarious in this movie, especially Rachel McAdams, who proves once again that she has hidden comedy chops that people often forget or she's underrated for. Underestimate, that's the word. Underestimate her for. And it's so one really fun thing about Game Night is that they have these really interesting and stylish transitions between frames that are basically film-like board pieces. And it's it's very cool, and it's just something that you wouldn't expect to put so that they would put so much time into a studio comedy like this. And it just has a great cast, and again, Rachel McAdams is a star in this and has some of the best lines of the year. So Game Night, definitely check it out, and don't underestimate it as many have Rachel McAdams.
You know, I have underestimated this film, and when I saw it, it kind of blew me away. Like, if I were to make a top 10 list of this year so far, and I know I haven't seen as many films as you guys, but I think this would for sure be in my top 5. And I'm not even, like, a comedy guy. I and one of the things I do want to respond to you, HD, is, like, one of the things I love about this film is a lot of comedies are shot so generically, almost like TV shows. Like, they, you know, do multi-camera setups so that, you know, the improv, they can capture the improv from multiple angles. And the directors here with Game Night just shot it cinematically. There's like this great sequence that's done all in, you know, quote unquote one take, that's fantastic, and one of the best one take scenes of this year thus far. I just had so much fun with this film, and yeah. So
if, and Jesse Plemons is hilarious in this movie.
He is great. He uses another scene stealer, too.
Yeah, he is fantastic. Let's move on to Sorry to Bother You, which was Ben's number 5.
Yeah, I've been hyping this movie ever since. Again, I saw it at Sundance. I've seen so many of these movies at Sundance. So this one actually comes out tonight or tomorrow, July 6th. So you can go see it immediately after you listen to this if you have the opportunity. And I would highly recommend it. It's a very, very weird movie. So go into that knowing that it's very strange. This is the first film from Boots Riley, who is an artist and an activist and a musician who's been around for a long time. And this is the most creative social satire I think I've ever seen. It is an unforgettable movie that is unlike anything that's ever existed before. Lakeith Stanfield plays a telemarketer who unlocks the ability to talk with a quote-unquote white voice, and I think it's who plays the voice? The guy who plays Tobias Fünke in Arrested Development. What was his name?
David Cross.
Yes, David Cross. So David Cross's voice comes out of Lakeith Stanfield's body, and he has this sort of superpower to become like a power caller, like a huge telemarketer who is able to close deals faster and better than anybody else in his field. And Armie Hammer plays a coked out company CEO. Tessa Thompson plays Lakeith Stanfield's girlfriend in it, and she's like a performance artist. And this movie, I mean, it's so creative, it's so out there, and there is a hard turn that it takes like three quarters of the way through that will leave you like pulling the hair out of your head, like, what the hell is going on in this movie? It is so creative and energetic, and it is just bursting with ideas. And I think it's, you know, for people who maybe listen to this show and go see a lot of things and are able to like easily predict the endings of movies. I try not to do that when I sit in theaters, but I know a lot of people, you know, they've just seen so many movies that it's easy for them to sort of check through the formula. This is definitely a movie that is going to mix up the formula a lot. And it's not something that you're easily going to be able to predict what happens in the end, because it goes to some really, really wild places.
Yes, it looks like it has an amazing cast. It's one of the best reviewed films of this year. It has 97% of Rotten Tomatoes. I am eager to check this out this weekend with either my MoviePass or AMC A-list. Let's move on to Black Panther, which was, you know, a juggernaut, one of the biggest films of all time at this point. HT, you and Ben both had this at your number 4 on your list, and this is the highest Marvel Studios film on this combined list. What did you think of Black Panther?
Black Panther is just a great film. It's definitely at this point, I think, making its way at the top between this and Winter Soldier for my top Marvel film. But I think that Black Panther is just so powerful in the messages it conveys, and in the way that Ryan Coogler, who directed and co-wrote this film, really was able to juggle so many different aspects and subplots within this film without making it feel too cluttered or overcrowded. And it's just chock full of great performances from Chadwick Boseman, who is almost overshadowed by everyone else just because of how good they are. Michael B. Jordan is amazing as Killmonger, the villain in this film, who is probably the best Marvel villain since Loki, and he's and is very multifaceted and really taps into a lot of the issues that African-American Black people are dealing with and concerned with today. And it does it in a way without vilifying or condemning certain aspects of like these conversations. It really brings to the fore like these sort of timely issues while making them into while putting it into an action lay box, essentially. So it is able to drive this blockbuster film and not feel like it's preaching or proselytizing in any way. And that's what I think is so amazing about Black Panther.
Yeah, and this is one of the best films of the year for sure. Ben, did you have anything to say about this film?
Letitia Wright is like the breakout star. She played Shuri, Black Panther's younger sister, and she is so good in this movie as sort of like a female Q. I know that there's a lot of talk about the CGI being really awful in the back half of this movie, but I think there's a lot of really, really good CG stuff in the first half of the movie. Like the way that Wakanda looks, the sort of shimmering futuristic city, a lot of the visual effects that are that Shuri's character is involved with. There's one point where she sort of drives a car remotely, and there's all like, it's so hard to explain the Wakandan technology, but it sort of it falls into place almost like a sand sculpture or something like that. And all of that I thought looked really great. So anyway, the idea that there is a little bit of some shaky CG and at the final fight of this movie does not offset the rest of how great this film is for me anyway. So yeah, that's why it's number four on my list too.
And it's funny you mentioned visual effects, because the next film is a sci-fi film which has many, and that is Annihilation, which was on all three of your lists. It was on HT's list at number 10, Chris's list at number 3, and Ben also on your list at number 3. Why did you love Annihilation?
Man, yeah, this one is so great. So the story follows a group of military scientists, all women, Natalie Portman, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Gina Rodriguez, Tessa Thompson, and Tuva Novotny, I believe is how you pronounce her name. They enter this area called the Shimmer, which is like a quarantined zone that there's this mysterious alien entity, I guess, that's landed there, and it's like this bubble that they walk into, and they're trying to track down Oscar Isaac's character, who's married to Natalie Portman in this movie. And it is the production design in this movie is off the charts. This world is really alien and off-kilter, but also tethered to reality in a really interesting way. There's this mutant bear that shows up in the movie that I'm sure people have probably seen screenshots of online. It is like one of the most horrifying images I've seen on screen this year. And man, there's just so much going on in this film. I realize this might be sort of a ridiculous comparison, but I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey for the first time a month or so ago. I talked about that on an episode of the show. And the ending of both of these movies, Annihilation sort of reminds me of that, in that director Alex Garland, who also wrote the script, is sort of going for this this primal association with the audience. I think he's trying to peel back layers of story and you know, get deeper than just the cerebral what is happening in this film, and getting to this emotional core of a place where it's really difficult to describe. But Chris, I'm sure you have something to say about this. But
I mean, I would probably just be echoing everything you just said. But yeah, this movie deeply affected me in way. I mean, I had read the book, so I had some idea of what it was about, but the film changes a lot from the book and becomes its own thing. And I don't know, this is just one of those movies that while I was watching it, I could tell, like, all right, some people aren't going to like this, but I love it. And I know years from now, we're still going to be talking about this movie, unlike, you know, hundreds of other movies that came out this year. So I don't know. This movie it holds a special place in my heart.
Do you know what I'm talking about, though, with the 2001 comparison? Oh. I'm not trying to like say that it's as great as a Kubrick movie, but I feel like on this sort of like elemental plane, it's sort of on the same level.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It has that same vibe, I guess you could call it, where it's, you know.
I've been using the 2001 comparison since I've seen it, because it kind of like goes into this abstract place where it's more about interpretation and how you feel about it than what it's actually, you know, what you're actually seeing from a story perspective. And I think that's going to determine if you love or hate this film, I think, because if you go into it, it kind of sets up as a mystery. And if you really want answers to that mystery, you might be disappointed. But if you're along for the ride and willing to, you know, the best films, I think, are ones that you can leave the theater and have discussions about and have your, you know, discuss your interpretation compared to someone else that is completely different. And I've just had so many great conversations about this movie. And Chris has done some remarkable work about this film on the site, which I will try to link to in the show notes as well. But let's move on to Hereditary, which is also a film on all three of your lists. I have yet to see this movie, guys. But HT had it at number 7, Chris had it at number 4, and Ben, you had it at number 2. So tell us about Hereditary.
Peter, you got to go see this immediately. I mean, you're talking about MoviePass. Like, go use your MoviePass. Do whatever you have to do to go see this movie, like, this weekend, because I have not been as deeply unsettled at the ending of a movie since, I think, Kill List, which came out in 2011. So that one also really, like, left me sitting in the theater, like, in the dark, just disturbed at what I had just seen. And Hereditary, which is the debut film from a new filmmaker called Ari Aster, is really a remarkable piece of work because it's a debut movie. I mean, it's so confident and controlled. It feels like it could have been the 10th film from this guy, but it's his first one out of the gate, and it's amazing to me that is what happened here. Toni Collette plays a family matriarch who's trying to really understand and process and come to grips with the death of her mother and keep her family together while some supernatural stuff begins to happen to them. And this film is like it's an examination of like grief and loss and suffering, but also it's wrapped up in this tapestry of horror that really the entire movie, it may as well have been called like Existential Dread the movie, because it's just like the dread builds and builds and builds from the very beginning. And it's so high in the beginning that there's no way that you could anticipate this film going where it goes, and it just ratchets and ratchets and ratchets and continues to just ramp up this this insane dread. It's not really a jump scare type of horror movie, and I know it's probably not going to be for everyone, but I think the performances, especially by Toni Collette, who I legitimately think deserves Oscar consideration for this film, are so good, and the movie is so unnerving and disturbing that, man, this one, I think people are going to be talking about this film for a long time.
See, I'm in such fear of this movie, and not fear because of, you know, what we're seeing and what I see in the marketing. I fear when I see the trailers, I kind of get the impression that it might not be for me. And I wasn't one of those people that loved The Witch, and I kind of get the impression that it's kind of like in that line of horror movie. But I definitely am going to see this because all of you guys love this movie, so I know I need to see it. It's just I'm afraid of seeing it because I have a fear that I'm not going to be on the same side as you guys.
I mean, I think, Peter, even to be fair, I think even if you end up not liking the story, you should definitely see it just because of the amazing performance that Toni Collette gives in this film. I think it's worth seeing for her work alone, even if you walk out of it going like, that wasn't really for me. I think you're going to want to bear witness to the work that she does in this movie.
For sure. Okay, let's get to Paddington 2, the last sequel on our list. And this is on all three of the lists yet again. Ben's list at number 9, Chris is at number 7. But HT, you had this at number 2. Tell us about it.
I love this film. Paddington 2 was probably the most entertaining experience I've had in a theater in a while. It just envelops you in this really warm and like wonderful vision of the world that I think is really necessary in a time like this. And it really expands upon the first film as well, which was kind of just a fun, cute family movie. And Paul King, who returned to direct Paddington 2 after directing Paddington, really ups his visual game in this film. His style can probably be compared best to like a Wes Anderson film. In fact, I think this was probably the best Wes Anderson film of 2018. Don't quote me on that. So Paddington 2 follows Paddington the Bear, who is now living and settled with the Brown family, and decides that he wants to buy a pop-up book at an antique shop to send to his beloved aunt back in Peru for her 100th birthday. And it's a pop-up book of London, and he wants to share with her how much he loves his new city. But unfortunately, it is a priceless antique that gets stolen by a nefarious villain played by Hugh Grant, who is also just amazing in this film. And I remember when the BAFTA Awards were first announced, and people were just like, were shocked that he was nominated for his role in this film in like a family comedy. I am not shocked in the least, because this is the most I've seen like Hugh Grant unleashed in a role. He is just all in. He's all invested in this character, and it's just so fun to see him having a blast in Paddington 2, and also giving like his most, I won't say nuanced performance, but definitely most like expressionful, if that's a word.
Full of expression.
Full of expression performance. It's just, it's such a great warm-hearted film, and I really love that Paul King was able to tap into what made the heart of Paddington so strong, and also give it a new sense of like visual whimsy and style.
And I know we're going long. I know people are going to get something out of this episode. So I think, you know, it deserves to give the time that we're giving to it. But we are up to our last three films, which are the number one films of each of your lists. And it should be mentioned that these three films, the lowest that they rank on any of your lists is number three. So I think there's a big agreement with these films. Let's start off first with First Reformed. Chris, you had this as number one. HD had it number three. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this movie blew me away. It's from Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver and a lot of other things. He wrote and directed this. It's Ethan Hawke plays this this reverend at this, you know, old historic church that almost no one goes to anymore, and he's going about his life in this sort of laid back, not very exciting way. And then he gets drawn into this story where one of his parishioners asks him to talk to her husband, because her husband's having a spiritual crisis. And the husband is just very alarmed about global warming and the state of, you know, the world as we know it. And it's almost like this guy passes a disease onto Ethan Hawke, where Ethan Hawke's character begins becoming obsessed with the same things this guy was obsessed with. And the whole movie is literally from Ethan Hawke's point of view. And we just watch him in this like slow descent into, I don't want to call it madness, it's just more like a descent into a spiritual crisis. And it's just a incredible movie. Ethan Hawke is so good in this. And without spoiling anything, the last like 10 or 15 minutes of this movie had me just like blown back in my seat. Like I left the theater just stunned at what I had just seen. So this movie is just remarkable.
So the opposite of the edge of your seat, you were blown back in the back of your seat.
Yes. I mean, it's like it floored me in a way. I just couldn't believe where the film was going. I was just so taken aback with it.
HD, you had this as number three. Do you have any additional thoughts?
No, I think Chris puts it really well. I think Ethan Hawke is amazing in it. And I also really love this film. It was definitely a film that like I was thinking about for weeks afterwards. And I'll say this in my later pick, but it's interesting to me that this is the one of two sort of Taxi Driver riffs that we have in this year.
Well, I am interested in seeing this. I have not yet seen First Reform, so that's another on my bucket list for this year. But let's move on to number two, which is I feel like it's another film from Sundance. Is that correct, Ben?
Yeah, it is. Sorry to be the annoying guy on this podcast.
See, this is how much I missed out from not being at Sundance. It's all these great films that Ben saw. Ben, tell us about Searching.
Yeah, so Searching is one that I've been hyping for a long, long time, and I legitimately think this is the best movie that I've seen so far this year. It's John Cho plays a father who is trying to track down his missing teenage daughter, so that is the very basic premise. But the movie takes place entirely across computer screens, so It's sort of like Unfriended in that way, but I feel like the visual style is more inventive. There are like push-ins and it seems like there's more going on in each frame than just like a locked off shot of one computer screen with like windows popping up here and there. There's the movie is cinematically, it's a cinematic movie despite the sort of gimmick of the presentation. The execution is such an important thing for a movie like this, and I feel like it's really executed at the absolute highest level. There are so many layers to what's going on in this movie, both, you know, in the actual story itself, but the way that it sort of tells a meta story about the way that we interact with technology and the way that we get to know people in real life versus how we know them online. And then there's also like literally a ton of layers in the movie because the editors of this film had to stack all these graphics on top of each other to recreate these different computer screens and websites and all of this stuff. And like I was listening to an interview with them, and they were talking about how the computers would just crash like every couple minutes while they were trying to make this movie because there are so many layers. It was like a city skyscraper in their timeline on the editing software or whatever. So this movie has a lot going on in it. And John Cho, who I always have enjoyed as a performer, is the lead in this movie, and he really gets to take the lead in an interesting way. And you know, we don't really see him in parts like this, whereas he's just like the regular normal guy, you know, the leader of an all-American family. There's also, the movie begins with a sequence that reminds me a lot of Pixar's Up. And you'll know exactly what I'm talking about when you see this. And this movie just, it rules so hard. I cannot wait for everybody to see it because it's so innovative and unique and just perfectly executed. The movie comes out on August 3rd. So just under a month before everybody can check this one out.
I am so excited to see this movie just from your enthusiasm since January. I just can't wait. But let's get to our last and final movie on this list. That is You Were Never Really Here. This was on Chris's list at number 2, but HD had it higher at number 1. So HD, talk about it.
So You Were Never Really Here is what I was kind of speaking of before in being a sort of modern riff on Taxi Driver. And it's a film directed by Lynn Ramsey, who previously directed We Need to Talk About Kevin. And it stars Joaquin Phoenix as a sort of hitman who is after this teenage girl who goes missing and is probably has been sold into child prostitution. And he sort of on the way uncovers a systematic corruption that's just bleeding through the rest of society. And it's such a great, really concise film. Chris wrote a really great piece on this, actually, in that the power of this film is in the scenes that you don't see, because most of this film takes place after or before the brutal bloodletting action. It's really poetic in a way that it kind of depicts this hulking mass of a hitman played by Phoenix, and he is just so wary and so broken down as a person that it becomes such like it's like becomes like a depressing modern take on Taxi Driver, in that it doesn't have that glamorization of, you know, the frustrations of masculinity in the sense that Taxi Driver did. It kind of continues that and touches on the sort of toxicity of the lifestyle that he lives and how it slowly wears away at him, both physically and emotionally. And it's just a beautifully shot, really tensely directed film that just really spoke to me. And Joaquin Phoenix is giving one of his career best performances. I truly think that he's just like, now that Daniel Day-Lewis is retired, the best actor of his generation. And Lynn Ramsey should be is in league with the best auteurs of today too, and I think that her name should be up there as well.
Chris, you had this at number 2. Do you have anything else to add here?
No, I mean, what HT said is pretty much spot on, and touching on that one element where what makes this film so unique for me is how little it shows you. It's a film that actually goes out of its way to keep the audience sort of without like a cathartic sort of reward. Like you want Joaquin Phoenix to be violent because the people he's dealing with are terrible people. So you kind of like, you want to see him, you know, enact, you know, I guess, vengeance or justice on this, on these people. And the film never actually gives you that. Like, I mean, you know, he commits violence, but it all happens in ways that's like conveniently off screen. And it kind of like, it throws you for a loop because you're so used to, you know, standard movies giving you that, you know, emotional release of, you know, someone enacting that, that righteous violence, so to speak. And this film doesn't do that. And that's, it's kind of unique in that way.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's Slash Film Daily. Next week, I hope to have Jacob and Brad talk about their top 10 of the year thus far. I think we've gone overboard with the time, so I'm not going to do the usual goodbyes. But you can find this podcast published every weekday on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. You can find the features we talked about today linked in the show notes. And please feel free to send us your feedback, questions, comments, concerns to peter@slashfilm.com. What movies did our group miss that came out in the first half of 2018 that should have been on their list but weren't? Please go rate and review this podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we'll see you tomorrow.